In 37 years and 3 months as a state official overseeing elections, Kevin Kennedy has overseen 365 elections in which 158.4 million votes were cast. But he's only going to be on the job for four more days, and that job is Director and General Counsel of the Government Accountability Board. Kevin, this is an exit interview. I didn't think it would come this soon.
Does that mean I get to tell you where the press could do better?
Sure, later on in the interview. Well, on July 1, the Government Accountability Board, which you have led, along with the six judges who set the policy for 8.5 years, goes away and is replaced by Ethics Commission and Elections Commission. So, in his benediction for the GAB, Judge Nickel, who served on the entire 8.5 years, said this: GAB was abolished for doing its job, quote, by politicians and outside groups who want no accountability. Do you agree with his assessment?
Absolutely. I think it's a very fair assessment. But let me correct you off the bat.
Please.
Our last day of business is June 29th.
Okay. Thank you.
The legislature couldn't even line it up with a fiscal year.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for that correction. So, are you angry about that?
You know, it's not, on some levels, it's not worth the energy to be angry. You know, I think there are better ways to challenge your energy. From my perspective, it's really unfortunate. I think we did our job. We did it well. I could not imagine the new structure or the structure that preceded us or a structure that exists in other states being able to navigate the tumultuousness of 2011, 2012.
Right. Well, I want to talk about that. But now let's talk about the new structures that kick in. Okay, correct me. June 30th?
June 30th.
You have a six-member elections commission, correct?
That's right.
And a six-member ethics commission.
And four members in each commission are directly appointed by legislative leaders, not by the governor by nomination, but directly appointed and accountable to those legislative leaders.
Which is a reaction to the GAB created January 1 of 2008, being run by six reserve judges, each of whom had to stand for reelection. So it seems to me that you went from one continuum of the other, six judges setting policy and making decisions for the GAB, back to the old model pre-2008 of partisan elections and ethics commissions. Can these new commissions succeed, given the fact that, as you alluded to, they are more controlled by lawmakers?
You know, only time will tell if it's going to succeed. The commissioners that I've met and worked with are all very good. They made some good choices as far as elections. The staff is what really runs the show in the sense of making sure things work on a day-to-day basis. The commissioners are there to set policy, make decisions, resolve disputes, and that might be where the conflict is, where they have to put their finger up to the wind or look over their shoulder to see what's the right decision, as opposed to what the former judges did, which was to look at the facts that were in front of them, apply the law, to that. You know, during the recall, we were sued 11 times, and every single time that decision was upheld in court, and we were sued by both sides.
The Elections and Ethics Commissions, are they going to turn into our version of the FEC and deadlock? Is that potential out there?
That potential is definitely out there, and we'll see. Again, you know, a lot of what's done is really the behind-the-scenes work. It's the working to make sure. I mean, on the ethics side, much of what we do is just answering the phone, helping campaign treasurers make sure that their reports are filled out so the public has that information, walking a public official through a potential ethical dilemma, mm-hmm. giving them advice on possible conflicts of interest, following up to make sure all the reports are done. You know, Wisconsin benefits, regardless of its oversight structure, from the fact that it has a very good culture. We do not have three former governors in federal prison. We really had a very, people want to do a good job. We get constant calls from the press. I mean, I always sort of chuckle that people would, you know, pose with these, you know, just totally off the wall vitriolic comments about our competence, and yet they and their staff were on the phone asking us for sensitive advice and thanking us profusely for helping them through that. Yet for political reasons, were willing to stand up there and spew things that had absolutely no basis in fact.
That's also true. That's been true of both parties, hasn't it?
It has.
You've been skewed by both D's and R's, haven't you?
That's right.
Okay. Well, I looked it up. Your first election, you joined the then elections board, correct?
That's right.
In April 1 of 79 as a lawyer, then you became the elections board director. In 1980, there were 2.2 million votes cast for president in Wisconsin. In 2012, there were 3 million. That's an increase of 31%. How many votes are going to be cast for president on November 8th of this year?
You know, it's hard to say. Initially, I was thinking we would probably get to 3.2 million, but we'll have to see just how many people are turned off by the choices that they have. I mean, I think that's the theme that's percolating now. We'll be able to look at it a little bit better in early October, but you know, so many people are unhappy with both choices based on the presumptive nominees, and so you really have to look. I mean, Charles Franklin and I talked about the election in April and how we both thought we would go with a little higher number, but we scaled it back just. And had we gone with a higher number, we would have both been right on the money on that. Instead, we were just a little bit behind it when we predicted our turnout. And it was hard. It's always hard to think how things are going to buck trends. But when people think they have a voice in the outcome, that's when they participate more. We had a higher turnout in 2008 than we did in 2012, mm-hmm. Because people, it was more settled in 2012 than it was in 2008.
Well, okay, using the long lines, you're 37 years and 3 months. Biggest changes in Wisconsin elections?
Well, the Government Accountability Board was probably one of the biggest changes.
Well, obviously.
You know, you can never predict the challenging circumstances that are going to come. No one could have predicted all the ramifications in the process that came with 2011. You know, we thought things were great. In February of 2011, the Packers had won the Super Bowl. The
yep.
Lombardi Trophy was home.
Yep.
And then the budget repair bill comes, and 100,000 people are inside and outside of the Capitol, and senators are running to Illinois. And
April election.
The April Presser election.
Versus Kloppenburg.
A statewide
it
recount.
It took you guys 5 weeks to recount that.
It did, and it validated how well the elections were run. The one thing that came out of that was a clerk, one rogue clerk, acting by herself and not having her data checked, you know, not building in that redundancy, and it created all kinds of turmoil. People would have accepted, I think, a 7,500 vote difference, which is what was confirmed in the recount. We went through and we looked every time there was a change. Every time they did a reporting unit, they were required to call in and tell us what the changes were. And if we saw a change of more than 10, we wanted to know why.
Mm-hmm.
And there were only 22 out of 3,600 where the vote changed by a factor of 10, you know, up 4, down 6, whatever, that we had to look at on that. Otherwise, it just shows what a great job the poll workers, the local election officials did. And they did it in a very high turnout election for April.
Now, you seem to say that the crucible of the GAB and the proof that it worked well is 2011-2012, because we went from the Act 10 to the Supreme Court recount to then in 2011 and 2012, 15 recall elections.
All with new, and all also redistricting on top, and redistricting done from the top down instead of from the bottom up.
That's
like
true,
I
forgot that. And so you, GAB had to go through how many names on petitions seeking recalls? More than 2 million?
Well, just in 2012, it was just under 2 million names when you add in both statewide and the four recalls. You know, I'm sure we were over 2 million when you look at the ones from 2011.
Okay. Well, your transition now. What are you going to do? Are you going to be a consultant? You're going to take your state ETF pension and do what?
Well, I'd like to say I'm going to do whatever I want, whenever I want, but the truth is that financial concerns and family matters tell me I don't have that much control over what happens. I'm hoping to stay involved in the area, providing consulting services. I don't want to work full-time at this point. I think there's a lot of life to be lived. I've got two children in their 30s. I'm looking forward to spending more time with them. I'm excited about Kit and I doing a bunch of things together. So,
if we get 3.2 million votes for president on November 8th, the juxtaposition is that you have a new elections board and a new campaign finance code. in terms of who can give and how much they can give. Do you anticipate some major problems with a new board and a new campaign finance code leading up to November 8?
I think the potential is there, but again, you know, partly because it's a brand new code, but it's a code we were pushing for since 2010 to get rewritten. You know, we took a lot of flack on the campaign finance side because the legislature wouldn't change the law when Citizens United came down. You know, the law was changing during that time period, and the legislature needed to keep up with that, and a total rewrite was in order. Now, there are choices that were made in that rewrite to shield a lot of activity from disclosure that could have been disclosed under current law, but it is much simpler. I mean, I used to say in the 70s and 80s when I was doing training, if you read our manuals, follow the instructions in the forms, it's not rocket science. By the late 80s, I said, it's rocket science. Make sure you call. Ask for some advice, because it was a challenge. Campaign finance is supposed to give people information. You know, I always look at, my mother always said, you're judged by the company you keep. What campaign finance does is it tells you who's lining up for and against people. It's a good way, it's a good barometer to evaluate people running for public office.
One of those changes allows businesses to donate, I think, to funds run by our lawmakers?
Right, through the legislative caucus, campaign committees.
Right. Was that a good change, allowing businesses and corporations to donate?
You know, that's
always... Or was it inevitable because of Citizens United?
It was inevitable probably because of Citizens United. It didn't have to be. The legislature chose to do it. It's very limited in terms of what it can be done. The money can't be used to funnel contributions to candidates. It can really only be used to build the infrastructure of the parties. There's some transparency that goes with that. You know, there's a lot of things that business can and does do that doesn't get disclosed. That really is outside the scope of regulation.
Do these new campaign finance rules favor one party or the other? They were written by Republicans, but do they favor Republicans?
Probably to a certain extent they favor Republicans because they require much more detailed itemization, which, you know, the unions have already lost a lot of clout, but now most of their contributions were very small and you didn't know who was giving. The work in, you know, if you're taking in 10,000 contributions of $15, you now have to list their name and address. I don't know that that always discourages people from making a campaign contribution, but it's certainly a lot more work for what is usually a volunteer job. You know, the data that's going to be in our database is going to be much more extensive. You know, we've seen that it's not beyond the ken of legislators to look at who signed a recall petition, and now they're going to who's given to try and harass and shame people. But on the other hand, I tell people, if politics is a participatory sport, if you're going to sign a nomination paper or a recall petition, put a yard sign up, it means you're stepping forward. So that also means you're taking on the courage to say, this is my view.
One of the biggest changes that you saw is the photo ID requirement. Is that a good public policy change? I know other states are adopting it, but from good public policy?
There's a lot of pluses to it, but the problem is that the legislature really chose to make it as restrictive as possible. You know, the narrow worldview was everybody has a driver's license, so they can get a Department of Transportation document. They divorce themselves from the reality that there are people who struggle, who have a very difficult time. If you sat through the two trials, the photo ID trial in the Eastern District of Wisconsin in 2014, the trial we just concluded
in federal,
you know,
court.
Just heart-wrenching stories of people who had very difficult times, who have to, you know, and probably the worst bureaucracy to work with is the Department of Transportation. You know, it was very challenging, and there were much simpler solutions that could have been followed. I mean, photo ID provides a certain level of confidence. Most of the people have the ID that they need, so in that sense, if it makes people comfortable with the process, I think it's a good thing, but you've got to be able to handle the exceptions in a fair way. And what we're doing is we're making people expend resources that they just don't have, people who are living on the margins to begin with, people who are challenged on several different levels, and they're entitled to participate as well. And it's something that, you know, too often we don't look at. Voting is supposed to be an inclusive matter. We let things fall. Most people aren't happy with the outcome.
You heard the argument from Republican leges and the governor that we needed photo ID, which is now law, to prevent fraud. How much fraud is there out there?
There's very little fraud out there. Very little. I mean, it was such a simplistic statement. We're going to make it easier to vote and harder to cheat. Yes, it's harder to cheat, but it's not easier to vote. It's harder to vote.
Has the cost of implementing photo ID been significantly raised the cost of elections for local governments?
I don't think it's really done that. I mean,
okay.
We've had a pretty smooth flowing process. The election costs tend to be pretty sunk. People don't notice them, which is where the strain comes in. The biggest challenge has been the fact we've had so many different changes, little nuances, mm-hmm. Not all of them increasing accessibility to the polls, and not all of them really making it more accountable.
What has the impact, looking back over your 37 years and 3 months, what's the impact of the huge amounts of money and the formation of and spending by third-party groups on Wisconsin politics?
Well, I think it's distanced the voters from the process. You know, everything is tailored to a 10 to 15 second soundbite. Voters are exposed to a barrage of phone calls, literature, that really are just a bunch of platitudes for all practical purposes. Television, radio, it's difficult to cut through the noise with that. And candidates lose out too because a lot of the message is out of their control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the beauties of our election system is that we have people who say, I think I should be elected. They step up, and that takes something in itself because more than half of them lose. They're not going to go on and get elected, but they're willing to say, I think I should be chosen to be your leader instead of that person. And they lose control of the process with all the money. Instead, you've got organizations, and it's on both sides, who are trying to shape their view and agenda of the world. And it's really created a chasm between the voters, a large segment of the people, and the power brokers.
Should Citizens United be repealed?
I don't know if repealed is the thing. I think we have to really look more carefully at how we regulate and disclose campaign speech. As I said before, you know, you want to know who's speaking. There's a strong benefit to that, but you don't want to discourage the speech. One of the problems with speech, I mean, and we saw this in the rhetoric around the dissolution of the GAB, you know, there was lots of speech. Most of it was false. You know, the legislators paraded their laundry list of what was wrong with the GAB, and we came back and we could rebut every single point of that. And that's one of the challenges that you see. I mean, our fight's just a small little issue compared to all the issues that are out there. And it's difficult for people to navigate a lot of the massive information that's out there. And it's a trade-off that we have because we want to foster that kind of discussion, but we also have to find a way to augment the speech of people who get drowned out by a single source sometimes.
What got GAB abolished, at least when you talk to Republicans, was GAB's role in John Doe 2. In his benediction, Judge Nichols said, look, a district attorney came to us, the attorney general came to us and asked us, so give us your version of how GAB got involved in John Doe 2, as much as you can.
Well, basically, I think we were presented with facts that suggested there was a violation of the law.
The law?
The law.
Banning coordination?
The law banning coordinated activity. The law banning corporate activity. There was a, you know, and it was a law that was been in place since 2000 in terms of what the Elections Board had applied the law. It had been reaffirmed by the Government Accountability Board in 2008. It was the advice on which we gave to everyone. And quite frankly, it would have been the death knell of the GAB had it chosen not to do that. we would have been co-opted like the former boards had been co-opted. You know, over a period of time, regulatory agencies often tend to become part of the institution that they're regulating. That's what we saw evolve with the two former boards to a large extent, at least by the decision makers on those boards. And had we said, you know, this is too messy, we're not going to get into this, the law might change, it's too much, too big of a risk to take, the Government Accountability Board did exactly what it was supposed to do. It says, there's smoke here, we need to see if it's a fire, we need to see if it needs to be extinguished. We never finished the investigation. You know, it was squelched by several lawsuits on this. I mean, it was proceeding by two fronts, but it was our obligation to do that. That's what we were created for. And it'll be interesting to see if the two new commissions, when they are presented with those facts, similar facts, whether they'll take that initiative or whether they'll deadlock.
But the Republicans say that GAB, well, I'm going to quote Representative Dean Knutson in his exit interview with Wisconsin Eye. He said, when you look at GAB's role in John Doe 2, quote, the referee had an agenda. He's referring to the GAB actively partnering with Milwaukee County DA Mr. Chisholm. How do you respond to Mr. Knudsen's comment, GAB, the referee had an agenda, an anti-Walker agenda?
It's malarkey. It's absolute malarkey. There's just no basis to that. You know, we looked on both sides for those kind of issues. The law requires us to work with district attorneys. A district attorney comes to us, or we make referrals to district attorneys. The board doesn't put its finger up in the wind and say, which way is the political wind going and how should we respond to that? And we shouldn't do that. The board doesn't look to see, neither does the staff, how can we advance our agenda? We look at what's the law that we've been given by the legislature, signed by the governor? How do we administer that and apply that? And that was our job. And just because it happens to be one side that gets nicked one time and another side that gets nicked another time, there's no agenda there. That is a way of trying to posture to cover up for a decision where you want to control the outcome. You know, politics is the only game where the players get to make the rules. And so they complain about the referee because they couldn't buy the referee.
In hindsight, with all the allegations that GAB, when it was involved in John Doe 2, trampled on privacy rights, led to raids in the middle of the night, confiscated computers, and is there anything GAB could or should have done differently in John Doe 2,
well, Kevin? First of all, you know, you're reading right out of the hyperbole in the playbook.
I am saying those are the allegations by the Republicans and the conservative groups. It's not me making that. Go ahead.
And I'm telling you those are mere allegations. You know, a lot of that was refuted. And again, we didn't do the raids just because we were consulted about, you know, the level of the evidence. We didn't control those. But even what I know about the search warrants, they were taped. You know, people made statements, and they have to recant them because instead of being, you know, foot soldiers stomping through the doors was what they tell the press, the tapes show a very cordial conversation. We weren't part of those raids. They linked them to that because it served a higher agenda.
I want to compare the old Elections Board non-response to the caucus scandal to the GAB's response to John Doe 2. Talk to me about that. Why did the old Elections Board not get involved in the caucus scandal, which fostered the calls for reform that led to GAB, which had a different response to John Doe 2? Talk to me about those two responses.
Well, two things. First of all, both boards wanted to participate. The district attorneys basically said, we will take anything you give us, but we're not giving you anything.
In caucus scandal?
In the caucus scandals. It was clearly a one-way street in terms of that. The district attorneys, both in Milwaukee and Dane County, you know, were using John Doe proceedings to gather evidence.
Yes.
And they were more than willing, if we were going to investigate, to do that. Neither of us had an investigatory budget. The Ethics Commission had the ability, Ethics Board, to go and ask for the money.
Ask for joint finance for the money to investigate
right.
members of the Assembly and Senate.
They could have, but, you know, the reality was, this was all, so we were stymied in the sense that if we wanted to move forward, we didn't have the resources and we did not have the support of the district attorneys, in the sense of they weren't going to offer resources to help us with the civil part of the litigation. And the DAs could actually do the civil stuff too. But we also had the fact that things had been institutionalized.
Well, that's my
question.
At
that point, both boards had been around long enough and the decision makers were close enough to the players being investigated. Now, I didn't see anything where they were being influenced by that. But on the other hand, nobody was coming to us with any of the issues.
Well,
you know, we had you know, the newspaper articles,
yes,
for starting points. But the district attorneys already had, you know, we couldn't interview the witnesses because they were already being tied up.
Before the DAs started their John Doe's and the caucus scandal, were you personally aware of the caucuses and that you had legislative aides being paid to do politics?
We did not have anything other than rumor and innuendo. We had nothing that we could go on. I mean, I had people who would walk into the office at 2 in the afternoon, whom I knew were staffers, to look at campaign finance reports.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're public reports. But they'd all sheepishly say, I'm on my lunch hour.
I'm on lunch hour vacation. You know,
but does that give us the basis to go behind closed doors and look? I mean, one of the things that came out of the caucus scandal that was driven by the Ethics Board and the Elections Board was an accounting, time accounting system for legislative staff.
Yes. Lawmakers have to sign off.
They have to sign off, and it was made very clear, there was a clear definition of what was political work that you cannot do, because the lines had blurred over the years. No question. I mean, that's the danger when you do not have, you know, when your watchdogs get institutionalized, when people don't want to come forward on those things. That's the danger that you run into. That system has worked very well, but I remember, you know, we were required to meet, and we still do, with legislative staff several times a year, not with the legislature, unfortunately, mm-hmm. to offer ethics and campaign finance training. In those first couple meetings, I mean, they were very reluctant to listen to us. At the end, it was like, we're really glad you come. It's too bad our bosses don't come to listen to this. It would be helpful for them, because now I have to translate it. And so the culture has changed in that sense, and that's a good thing. And that came from the initiative of the Ethics Board staff, Roth Judd, and for myself and John Becker, saying, here's how we can make this work from a cultural change. And it did.
You just said the GAB didn't have a chance to conclude its John Doe 2 investigation. Let me ask, do you believe that groups supporting Governor Walker's surviving the recall broke the law?
I think there was evidence to suggest that there was violations of the law there, yes.
Why is that old ban against coordination, why was it a good thing then? Now, it's been struck down by our Supreme Court, but why was it a good thing?
Well, when a candidate is coordinating their campaign activity, the true source of their support's not disclosed. You know, if a candidate is saying something, but it's being paid for by an outside group, it's the candidate's mouth is moving, but the words are coming from somewhere else. You don't know that. The whole idea is to judge people by the company they're keeping. Give voters some information. What we look at. There's also, how do we put some reasonable restrictions on the amount of money that can be given directly to a candidate? The courts have said, we're not going to stop how much money gets spent on speech, but whatever goes directly through the candidate. And if candidates or their agents are coordinating that activity, you're getting around those limits on the influence of candidates. Now, most candidates are going to be insulted to think that they could, quote, be bought.
Mm-hmm.
But we all know, we see it in all walks of life, that you are influenced by the people who give you money, who buy you dinner, who invite you to lavish receptions. It's the human element of this, and that's part of why we have watchdog agencies, is to guard against that normal human element, to look at your self-interest first. It's a great survival instinct, but when we're in a society, there's certain things that we put together for the, you know, that we give up for the greater good. And it's a delicate balance. And it's particularly challenging in the United States, and I don't regret it, that we want to foster as much communication as we can in our discourse. My Canadian counterparts don't have a First Amendment, and there's very tight restrictions on speech in political campaigns and spending. And I'm not sure that it's a better system because of that. Probably a lot less cluttered in the airwaves, but people have to recognize when you're in a democracy, it is a participatory sport. It's not a passive activity, and not everyone wants to be active, but that's why we try to motivate people to participate.
The district attorneys in Milwaukee and Dane, and maybe there's one other, have asked the U.S. Supreme Court to take jurisdiction here and say, because of the participation by Justices Gableman and Prosser, the John Doe should be reauthorized. Do you hope the Supreme Court says, yes, because of the conflict, we're sending it back to reauthorize and continue the John Doe?
Well, I hope it's done mostly because the decision that was written was such an embarrassment. It was intellectually void.
No, you're talking about the decision by our state Supreme Court.
I'm talking about the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision that had absolutely no reasoning to it. It was basically taking platitudes, citing news sources. It was an embarrassment to lawyers in the state of Wisconsin to have our Supreme Court and those justices that wrote the opinion write something to that effect.
Should Justice Gableman and Prosser have recused themselves from that?
That's difficult to say. I think that's a legal question that needs to be looked at. It certainly needed to be examined. I think the Caperton decision suggests...
Out of West Virginia.
Out of West Virginia suggests that that ought to be weighed. But, and I think the quality of what you saw in the opinion reflects exactly what the influence of that kind of activity was.
Let's play this out. If the U.S. Supreme Court says, yes, these two justices should have recused, we're sending this back to Wisconsin. Well, now we have an elections and an ethics commission. What are some logical next steps? Do you think a John Doe 2 could be completed by the new, either the two state agencies or the two DAs?
Well, I don't think it would be completed, mostly because there's a statute of limitations issue.
Okay.
So the civil acts are done. You know, if the district attorneys choose to invest their resources on the criminal activities, they would have that option. But there would not be any basis to go forward from anything out of 2011 or 2012.
But it's the biggest disappointment in your 37 years and 3 months? The dissolution of the GAB?
On one hand, we were important enough, we did enough good things that people who wanted to control the process needed to squelch it. That's almost a vindication of how good we did our jobs. So, again, I like to look at things and say, there was so much good that came from this. Wisconsin was so widely recognized. We see these issues all across the country. We see the deadlock at the federal level. The process, it's always rough around the edges. I think what happened was very good. I think when people call it a failed experiment, I think that they are using that simply to justify their decisions to take control, and that's really what's driving it. And that shouldn't surprise us. We see that all the time. There's a reason why most of our elections and campaign finance and lobbying are overseen by either an elected or appointed Secretary of State. There's some very honorable Secretaries of State, but they're part and parcel of a partisan process and an agenda, and we've seen in some states where that has played out very unfortunately. We've seen other states where it was handled very well in a tumultuous time. I keep coming back to who would you want in control during the troubles of 2011 and 2012? And I cannot see a Secretary of State model, a bipartisan model that would have steered us through that, where we all came out and people may not have been happy with the outcome, but they all accepted the process and the outcome. Probably the biggest compliments that I received throughout that time and since have been people said, you know, there was just so much hubbub and tumultuousness and I didn't know where to turn. And I'd see you on TV and you were so calm that it just reassured me. And that came from people on both sides. They knew that we were going to pull these elections off, and there was going to be an outcome. And remember, the incumbents won almost all of them, all but four of those, which is not an unusual situation. But we had a process in place under our law, and it ran well. We had it validated through a statewide recount in the Supreme Court race, and we learned some great lessons for training clerks. My colleagues in other states look at that and look at that with admiration about how well our agency could run that. And they weren't looking just at the election challenges. They were looking at the ethics challenges, the lobbying challenges, and definitely the campaign finance challenges. And I cannot think of a better group of individuals, a better structure to have handled that, because you know that we would not have had unanimous decisions to start an investigation, to make certain decisions about the timing of recalls, the validity of recall petitions, how the process is going to work, if it had been entrusted to hand-picked individuals by partisan by legislative leadership. The fact that we had trained decision makers who had sifted through these problems in a career on the bench or on the appellate courts reflected well. The fact that we had a professional staff that was nonpartisan then, will continue to be nonpartisan, that did not have an agenda, even if people saw the outcome as agenda-driven. I would love to have opened up the doors. You know, when they created the GAB, we moved campaign finance out of the discussion that was public at the old elections board, where people could hear the back and forth. And again, it was not always pretty, to behind closed doors. It would have been nice to have, if people had heard the discussions, had seen what the staff was presenting on our investigation that was coupled with the John Doe, I think you'd have a whole different perspective. People would have been saying, why aren't you doing more?
When people ask you, when someone just beginning their career, maybe a law school graduate, asks you, should I enter public service, how do you answer?
Absolutely. I think you should. I mean,
with all those arrows sticking in your back, you still answer absolutely?
I do. I wouldn't trade this experience for the world. It's a great way to observe the process. If you have to have faith in what you're doing. I mean, we're not a dictatorship. We're not an oligarchy. We are, you know, a democratic process where we're electing representatives to speak for us. And if you're going to do that, you want to build a structure that people have confidence in. And I said Wisconsin has a good culture for that. And it was there when I stepped in. Mm-hmm. We have so many things that foster participation. You know, Election Day registration is really a very good thing for getting people in a very mobile society, recognizing those needs, and we've got protections in that. And the photo ID actually probably strengthens that process. I will say that I've worked with some really good people, both as board members on both boards, but my colleagues have been amazing. And I didn't realize until, you know, we used to have a very tiny little staff, you know, that was, it peaked at 14 people at the elections board, but we were operating at 11 at the time of the Help America Vote Act, and we had to build a whole new elections infrastructure. And we had a lot of people who came in during that time period, and as they left, because they were temporary jobs, they all thanked me for the opportunity to see how this process works. You know, elections are more than getting up on election day and going to the polls, going home and turning on the TV to see the results. There's a lot of work by 1,854 municipal clerks, mm-hmm. 72 county clerks, the 30-plus people at the GAB that are working every day for this. You know, when they went to restructure us and they said, what's the best time to do this? My answer was, if you haven't done it now, you need to wait till 2017. Because we are in the midst of preparations for 2016 right now, and that was in September of 2015.
Decades later, are you optimistic about the dialogue that amounts to politics nationally, or pessimistic?
I'd probably come up with a different word. It's probably just more frustrating than anything else.
Frustrating.
It's very frustrating. You know, you really hope that it will go to a better level. you know, the way the media is structured, sound bites are it. And we saw, you know, I mean, I was constantly battling sound bites throughout the dissolution process, because there's so much more to what makes government run. And people need to recognize that you need government if you're going to have a society, if you're going to have some structure to all these people living and working together. And that does require working. It was interesting during this process that I got personal phone calls from two people straight out of the 80s. Governor Thompson called me up after I announced my retirement just to thank me and say, you know, I don't think we always saw eye to eye, but I'm really kind of, you know, I just want to say I respected what you did and I appreciated what you did and I always felt comfortable. That same week on a Saturday at my desk, I got a call from former Senator Feingold, basically saying the same thing. And he says, you know, I always kind of thought maybe you leaned my way, but I wasn't sure. And I didn't tell him one way or the other. Right. But he says, I just want to thank you again. A lot of confidence. Two people, very different, who recognized how the system worked in the sense of a civil approach to things. And that's what I'm hoping we get back to at some point.
Kevin Kennedy, Director and General Counsel of the Government Accountability Board for a couple more days. Good luck on wherever your next career and personal paths. Good luck.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Congratulations on 37 years and 3 months as a public servant.
Thank you.
Thank you.